Thank you so much for being available to talk to us.
My pleasure.
The first thing we want to know is whether it is true that the United States has been delivering MRAPs. Based on what we know, Uzbekistan is getting 308 MRAPs, mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles, and 20 armed recovery vehicles. Is that true?
It is true that the U.S. is providing MRAPs, mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles, as you said. 308, as you said, and another 20 vehicles to support those MRAPs. They're sort of like tow trucks and repair for ones that might break down. We're doing that under a program called Excess Defense Articles, or EDA, which essentially provides military material not needed by the U.S. military. That is it is an excess of requirements, and provided to countries that seek it, but only after a pretty involved process of review that goes on first to determine whether the need is there, whether the appropriate equipment exists, and also we look at a variety of things regarding regional balance, for example, whether this will affect the regional military balance in some way before deciding to provide it.
Why does Uzbekistan need them, in your view?
Well, our determination was that Uzbekistan required these vehicles, and they made the case, of course, to support their efforts at counterterrorism, counter-narcotics. They will all be provided to the Ministry of Defense, Uzbekistan's military, and can only be used by Ministry of Defense elements. These are definitely defensive vehicles. They're inherently defensive. And also, we consider them to be non-lethal. They're intended to protect personnel, crews, and passengers in areas that there might be explosive devices, mines, and so on. So, under those circumstances, and for the purposes of counterterrorism and counter-narcotics, we thought it was a legitimate request and decided to fulfill it.
Based on the size of this military transfer, we can see that this is perhaps the largest military assistance that U.S. has provided to Central Asia. Have you informed the neighbors too? I know you don't have to, but you just talked about the regional balance. I'm sure countries like Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan would want to know that this is happening. And this is happening as we speak, right? The delivery is a long process from what we understand.
It is. It's a drawn-out process. So, I mean, first on the delivery, just to note that it began in early December, the first days of December, and will be going on over a number of months. And that's because the way the EDA program works, basically a country is offered these excess articles as is where is. That's the term of art that's used, meaning in the condition that they are, even good or bad, but, you know, we hope it's good enough to be used, obviously. And wherever the location is, and these particular MRAPs were in a number of different locations. None were in Afghanistan, by the way. I know that question has come up. These are not coming from Afghanistan, coming from other places.
So the U.S. is not just dropping them off the trains as they are passing
As they pass through. No, that's not happening. So on the question about the neighbors and any concerns there, first of all, I should mention that we made similar offer of excess defense articles to all Central Asian countries. Tajikistan and Kazakhstan have also expressed interest, and we're working with them to determine, A, whether any of the excess defense articles are things that they need, and B, whether we have what they want. So it's a two-way process. As far as the delivery of the MRAPs and that decision, we were very transparent with the Central Asian countries, with all of them. We made sure they were aware it was happening so as not to have any surprises. So this was it was done in a kind of, I would say, transparent way.
So these vehicles were somewhere in the United States, and who pays for the transportation? The United States or the countries themselves?
Some were in the United States and some were in other overseas locations. The transportation is paid for by the country that's receiving them, because, again, it's the as-is, where-is. So if they're in the U.S. and they need to get to Uzbekistan, it's Uzbekistan that pays the cost.
What kind of controls do you have in place to make sure that these vehicles are used for the intended purposes?
So we have pretty rigorous end-use monitoring, as it's known, And so in this case, the Defense Department, which is responsible for this equipment, will be checking up on it to make sure after the fact that it's being used by the elements, which is in this case the Ministry of Defense, and for the purposes that it was intended. So that's a pretty standard practice when it comes to this EDA equipment.
So, I mean, factually, Uzbekistan has been the only country which has got an EDA so far?
Well, within Central Asia, yes. It's the only country right now. I mean, actually, if we look historically, there may have been cases of Central Asian countries even before I can remember getting some of this, because EDA is not a new thing, of course. It's been around for a while. But in this current round, and certainly within the last year, it's the only country to have gotten it. As I said, we are in discussions with other countries about at least the potential of them receiving some.
While some argue that you are essentially rewarding an oppressive regime by giving these toys, as they say, you know, there is also other side which argues that by strengthening the security relationship, you're opening up new opportunities, new ways to work with these governments. Where do you stand?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the way I would look at it, the way we look at it, is that we have a number of interests in our relationship with Uzbekistan and with other countries in the region. And we want to maintain a robust relationship and a robust level of cooperation in all areas. Security is an area where we do share interests and share concerns. We also are worried about the terrorist threats. We're very concerned about counter-narcotics, about the narcotics trafficking that goes through the region. And in those areas, we want to cooperate, because cooperating with countries like Uzbekistan is the best way to address those threats. At the same time, it's very, very much a part of our foreign policy in the region and globally, frankly, to emphasize the importance of democratic development and respect for international human rights. And that's not just because of our values, which of course is what drives a lot of this, but also because we think in the long term that's the best guarantee of stability, internal stability in all these countries. So we have robust engagement with Uzbekistan on those issues, on issues of democracy and human rights, and on security. And we think it's possible to pursue both and to try to maintain that balance in the relationship.
What do you mean by robust when it comes to the promotion of human rights and democracy?
Well, there's a number of elements to it. I'll just mention a few of them. I mean, most recently, we had the chance to raise directly in a diplomatic dialogue the issues of concern in that area in our annual bilateral consultations that were held first days of December in Tashkent. And in that meeting, we went through the whole litany of issues that some of which we've been raising a number of years, many of which are highlighted in our annual reports about prison conditions, treatment of prisoners, about restrictions on civil society and media, about labor rights and concerns about particularly the annual cotton harvest and labor issues surrounding that, and also about religious freedom. And it's a chance for us, that ABC was a chance for us to go through in detail where our concerns are and to hear the perspective of the government of Uzbekistan. But in addition, we had another opportunity at this ABC, which we hope will become a regular feature of our dialogue, which was to bring the civil society groups themselves into the discussion. So we actually were able to hold a round table. We decided to do it not just a sort of broad discussion about civil society, but to focus on a theme. And the theme that was chosen was prison conditions. And so there were, I don't know, something like 6 or 7 NGOs at the table, government of Uzbekistan officials who work on prison issues, Ministry of Interior, Bureau of Prisons, and so on. And then the U.S., the U.S. diplomats and agency people who were there, and talked about some really difficult issues, and got to hear the perspective of civil society at the same time. So diplomatic exchange is one, these kind of round tables where you can bring in other voices is another. And then I guess the third element of this robust engagement is maybe less engagement and more about just us stating our position is through the annual reports we do on human rights, religious freedom, and trafficking in persons, where, you know, we give very candid assessments of where we think there are shortcomings.
Well, the United States has been raising the human rights violations issues and other civil society, for example, issues with Uzbekistan for a while now. I mean, in every ABC, pretty much. And I know that you haven't held this position for a long time, but is it your observation that the attitude from the Uzbek side has changed? How serious are they when they discuss these issues with you?
I wouldn't attempt to analyze people's motives or to just, you know, make a determination of how serious someone is. Judging from the dialogue and the actual words, I think they are serious about discussing, about acknowledging where there are shortcomings and deficiencies. Not always. I mean, it's a give and take, and sometimes we raise a point and they'll defend, you know, the way they do things and say this, you know, we disagree with your assessment. But there's a willingness to talk frankly, to invite, as I said, you know, outside groups into the room. I should mention that, you know, that those outside groups, it's a mix of NGOs who are maybe more, perhaps more sympathetic or work more closely with government, and others that are critics, that are, you know, outspoken critics of government action. So it was a mix
of which you don't really have a lot on the ground.
There aren't a lot, but there are a handful, and some of them were there. So judging from their words and the way in which they're expressed, I think they are serious about talking about these issues. Of course, the proof is in the pudding, as they say, and the talking also has to be backed up by action and concrete steps. And we try, to the extent possible, to focus on very specific steps and actions that we think would be helpful in moving them in that direction.
We know that there's a new Central Asia policy in place. Can you describe it briefly?
I guess I can give you, to really describe it, do it justice, probably require a longer period, but I would say it highlights, first of all, the ongoing and sort of abiding U.S. interest in Central Asia's development that goes beyond, even though our concerns about stability in Afghanistan are still very important, it goes beyond that. So the strategy talks about our other interests, whether it's stability in the region because of its location, you know, and important crossroads between Europe and Asia, whether it's about, you know, energy resources and economic growth that we want to see in the region because it's a benefit to the world, frankly. So the strategy first emphasizes that and then talks about some of the challenges that we face and how we're going to emphasize what we're going to emphasize in our policy to meet those challenges. You know, there's security challenges that are out there, obviously, and I talked about some of those earlier, terrorist threats, narcotics trade, weapons of mass destruction movements across borders that we want to see stop. There are economic challenges, the need to have some better economic growth that creates jobs for people so that they're not as dependent on migrant work in other countries, for example, and also for stability's sake. And then there are, you know, internal reform challenges that have to be addressed. And as I discussed earlier with Uzbekistan, the same is true elsewhere in the region, that, you know, political reform, respect for human rights, those issues have to be addressed. So the strategy talks about all these elements and tries to give some ideas of how we can engage on addressing them.
So how high would you say is the promotion of human rights and democracy in that new strategy?
How high is
it?
It's very much there. It's, we attempt not to do a strict rank ordering, because I think that's difficult to, in any given case, to say exactly it, always one thing is more important than the other. And we think it's possible to, as I said earlier, to pursue all of these priorities in parallel. You know, as we sometimes say, we can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Will this new strategy have any impact on funding? Will there be more money for Central Asia or less money in the coming years?
Well, those of us who care about Central Asia and focus on it can always hope. That's our hope is that the resources will follow. But, you know, we also recognize the reality of very constrained budgets, and that's, you know, not even just on foreign aid, but in general, the fiscal situation that is not expanding right now. And there are a lot of trade-offs and a lot of other crises in the world, a lot of other important interests that need to be funded. So so we're not, I can't say that I'm optimistic that we're going to see big increases, but we hope that we'll continue to get the funding we need to continue to make an impact.
And what will be the priorities for the current funding?
For the current funding? Well, you know, I don't see there'll be any big shifts in the kinds of things that we've been used doing. So for example, I think we'll continue to have good funding for exchange programs and education programs because we think it's really important to have that person-to-person engagement with people in Central Asian countries. We'll continue to have some funds for economic reform efforts and the sort of grassroots poverty alleviation kinds of programming. There's a lot more of that in Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan as there has been than in the other three countries, but some elements of that. And again, you know, I think security assistance will continue to be part of our assistance because it touches on issues that are critical to our interests as well as the countries of the region.
What did the United States think of the recent parliamentary elections in Uzbekistan? State Department has not said anything, but the OEC observed in a limited way, and the conclusion was that Uzbek voters had no electoral choice.
Yeah, well, you know, I think I would say that we largely agree with the OSCE statement that came out. I guess it was ODIHR that issued a statement on the election. There were some procedural improvements made in the actual conduct of the election, but you know, it fell short in other respects when it came to the playing field for candidates. So you know, when it comes to elections, I think we generally are, you know, always want to see some incremental improvements from election to election, but we recognize Uzbekistan has some ways to go.
And the campaign for the presidential election in Uzbekistan is on. I'm sure you're following the process.
Mm-hmm.
What will be the message from here?
You know, I'm not sure that we'll have a specific message for the presidential election, to be honest. You know, I think we'll be watching it closely. I think it's obviously, President Karimov, who's now been officially nominated, has some advantages.
I want to ask any predictions or...
I'm not going to make any predictions, but, you know, we're always interested in elections in our region and watching how they result. But, I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line is that we will work with whatever government is in Uzbekistan, whatever leadership is there, to pursue common interests. That goes no matter what.
And would that be the same message for Tajikistan, who are also getting ready to elect a new parliament early March?
Yes, I mean, in Tajikistan, again, I think ODIHR will be there, and, you know, as an OSCE member, we will be contributing to their efforts to monitor the election. We're not, you know, doing a large program around the election as we sometimes do in other countries at other times, but you know, we'll be watching with interest to see how that one comes out. I know in Tajikistan there are some opposition parties that will be running candidates in that election, and so we'll be hoping for and urging that it be as a free and fair process as possible.
You have a new ambassador in Uzbekistan. There will be a new ambassador in Kazakhstan. There will be one in Kyrgyzstan. So you're changing your top diplomats in the region, and many are wondering what will change. Will they bring a different kind of message? What will be their priorities? How different will they be from the previous ambassadors?
I don't expect any serious changes. I mean, I think that, you know, they're there to carry out the president and the secretary of states and the U.S. government's policy in the country. All of them are seasoned diplomats. Of course, two of the new ambassadors are not new to the region, even. They're switching places, right? Ambassador Kroll in Astana and Ambassador Spratlin in Tashkent have, you know, just finished 3 years of serving as ambassadors in the region. You know, Ambassador Mustard, who's going, is actually already in Ashgabat, I think he just arrived the other day, has served quite a bit in the post-Soviet region. He, you know, did a couple of tours in Moscow, and he's actually been to he was in Turkmenistan, I think, in 1979, when he was with USIA at the time, U.S. Information Agency. So he, they're all very knowledgeable about the region and the country they're going to, and they also are knowledgeable about U.S. policy, and I think they'll faithfully carry that out. There's always, you know, variations in personality that people bring, you know, put their own personal stamp on it, but I don't expect it to result in any shifts.
Thank you.
You're welcome.